Jean Schaefer is in surgery right now,
I believe.
She had surgery at 8 a.m., so they might be done already, but that's kind of the report. She broke a bone in her leg, is what happened, and that happened, I want to say Friday night. Yeah, she broke her femur. So they're doing surgery. She's at Beacon Hospital right now, and that's all I know. I'll probably go visit her after church sometime. I will. So, that is the update. Also, coming up this coming Sunday, after church is our Harvest Fest. I hope all of you plan on attending. It would be fantastic. It is a great time for family, but it's also a great time to invite a friend. If you know somebody who's unchurched or just doesn't have a church home, we'd love to have them. We'd love to have them here. So please, we bought extra food this year because we want people to bring friends. So bring friends. So we're not left with a bunch of food. That's right.
That's right. Help America stay thin. Bring friends. I like it. All right, so we're off of kind of the study plan. The study plan kind of ended last week with the study of the Lateef. And so what I wanted to do today is I want to talk about some New Testament sites, two sites in particular that I went. I think I had some pictures of some other sites thrown in here, but two sites in particular. One is Bethlehem, and we're going to look at Bethlehem a little bit. And then the other one is Capernaum. We're going to look at Capernaum a little bit. Again, both of these sites, for what it's worth, both of these sites are heavy into tourism, and they are the least original of the sites that I went to. Especially Capernaum. Capernaum, you're going to kind of see it in my voice. I was actually a little bit disappointed with Capernaum. I was hoping for something else. I saw everything I wanted to see, and that's great, but I'll show you some pictures here, and you're going to see it. It's just too much. You know, it's like they've really pushed the envelope on it. I also have some pictures of a few churches here that we'll kind of like to look at, and so on and so forth. But those are the two main sites that we're going to look at. Again, with our group, if you haven't already, if you're computer or tech savvy at all, create a Faith Life account and join the Sand Prairie group. It'll take me a little bit. I'll make you a member. There are some benefits to this that are really nice. For instance, it has a prayer list on the side, and I've been trying to keep it updated with most of our big concerns. So yesterday I put on there jeans. You would have gotten a notification that we could be praying for jeans. That's one of the benefits of there. Also, our next study, we're going to be looking at Paul, and we're going to be reading through Acts. This actually has a thing where you can put a Bible reading plan, and I'll probably publish it through the Faith Life account. And so there's just some benefits that come along with this. And it's what we use for our software and for a few other things. So there are some benefits to it. You don't have to, obviously, but it helps us stay connected that way. And you get access to a little Christianized Facebook-like thing, I guess you might say. So anyway, more or less where we are now, we've spent most of our time in the southern half of Israel. And really with this, we're going to be going up north. Now, Bethlehem's actually over here, but we're going to be going up north of Galilee. All right, so this right off the bat, this is Bethlehem Lutheran Church. This is the Lutheran Church that's actually in Bethlehem. We went to the church, we were able to walk through the church and in the church. I'll have some pictures of that here in a little bit. But what's really unique about this church is it has a first century cave underneath it. We were not able to see it. They could not get the key. Remember I told you guys a week or two ago, because they had a holiday, and it was a kind of a short announced holiday. And apparently in Palestine, whenever somebody announces a holiday, you do not work. So, I guess we could not get the key to the basement. But this is Bethlehem Lutheran Church. It's a very, very pretty church. You know, all the churches really there, the Christian churches especially, were very beautiful, very pretty. This is a stained glass windows. You can't really see it from here. I'm going to show you pictures of other stained glass windows, but this one in particular is significant because there's a little hole right there. You can't, like I said, you can't really see it. This picture doesn't do justice. There is a little hole in that. During the Second Infantado, whenever the Palestinians revolted against the Israelites, that is the only thing that was broken in this church. They had riots. They had, you know, Molotov cocktails. They had the whole works. People basically just rioting and destroying everything in sight. This church was left untouched, except for that one little spot in the window where a rock went through. And that's it. Here's another estate. They had beautiful stained glass windows, so you had to kind of look at them. It is. We have a gorgeous stained glass window. But they had beautiful stained glass windows all throughout the church. And as you can tell, it's all stone. Everything was stone. We tried to read their hymn book, but it was in Arabic, so it didn't really work real well for us.
What does that bring back to the church? You know?
Good question. I don't know. No.
And sorry. Has it always been the Lutheran church?
As far as I know, yes. I think in terms of the Lutheran aspect, it has always been since it was built. I do not know when it was built, though.
Was there a heating system in that church?
If it did have one, it was not on.
The reason I asked, when we was in England, we went to many churches, Lutheran churches, that were built back in the 12th century,
mm-hmm.
and were now Lutheran churches, and they had no heating, no that must be.
I mean, this was obviously built prior to that. Now, if they've added one since, I do not know. I can't remember. I just know that there was no AC or anything. They had, like, a main building. Like, this is, like, the church, and then they had kind of, like, a main office building. Ironically, this is, like, on top of that, so this is actually up, not down. But if you went down to their main building or over to their main building, that did have an AC unit. It was very much a newer building. But the church itself, that I couldn't tell you. Just give you a little, here's our, again, the light was a bit bad, you can't see him, but here's our tour guide. He's a Palestinian Christian. Now, he's not a Palestinian Lutheran, but he is a Palestinian Christian. There's not many of those, by the way, and they're chasing them out day by day. It's kind of like the one thing that the Palestinians and the Jews agree on, is they don't like Christians. They don't necessarily persecute them through physical violence. They persecute them through things like jobs. It's really, if you are a Christian, it is really, really hard to get a job. And they don't ask you on your profile, like, if you're a Christian or not. They ask your last name. And they know you through association by your last name. So if your last name lines up with a Christian group, you're just not going to get a job. It's really, really hard. In fact, that's one of the reasons we wanted to hire him. Our tour guide knows about this, and so he asked specifically for a Christian tour guide to Palestine instead of basically a Palestinian one. Not a Palestinian, an Arabic one. Yeah, it felt like that a little bit. They're really, really tiny. They're really, really crunched. We had one of our people that was with us, our group, stand up and read the Christmas story. Because what else do you do in Bethlehem, all right? You read the Christmas story. So that's what we did. We read the Christmas story. This is not the Lutheran Church of Bethlehem. This is the Bethlehem Church. That's actually it's three different churches. It's Anglican, Catholic, and Orthodox. And this is the place that houses the supposed first century cave where Jesus was born. And that's this series of churches. This is inside. By the way, this is the line. And by the way, this is not this. It goes all the way up and around here. So that's where it is.
Now, another thing I want you guys to notice, notice the floor. This is brick that was built on top of it later. In a couple pictures, I'm going to show you something, and it's going to be from over here. They dug underneath the brick, and they found a mosaic floor. And if you go over here and you lift up one of the panels, you can actually see the mosaic that they're trying to restore underneath. And so they're working on restoring the original mosaic floor. Also, in the midst of this, there was an Orthodox service going on right up here. And so as you can imagine, we had a huge, massive line, a service going on over there, and our tour guide trying to talk to us, saying, oh, no, go over here. So it was good times, but a little crowded. Just another view of the line. So again, and this was all the way out the door. We kind of squeezed through the line to get through here, to get into the door. The line was, the tour guide guessed, about 3 to 3.5 hours long. Not ours, but we didn't go to the park. There it is. That is the floor underneath that brick. Now they're working on restoring it, and I'm sure this is a restored piece that they're showing us, but that's what the floor underneath that brick looks like. So if they take the brick off of the top of it, you know, again, with some restoration, that's what it would look like. So they're working on it, restoring a piece at a time, but they're kind of it's a pretty big project, as you might guess. Yes?
What is the theology of the Lutheran Church there compared to, say, ours or ELCA or something we're more familiar with?
To be completely honest with you, most synods throughout the world are pretty closely tied with the LCMS. Now, that doesn't mean all of them are, but a good chunk of them are. Would be considerably close to that branch of theology. You know, you might put it in terms of the Wells, maybe, but I don't think I would go that far. There are some that are connected with the ELCA. I don't want to make it sound like the ELCA doesn't have any ties, but most of the ties with the ELCA would be in, like, say, Europe. Europe, if you went to a Lutheran church in good chunks of Europe, you'd find more ELCA-branded style churches. But whenever you get into Africa, some of the other places that tend to be more conservative, and the more conservative branches tend to line up more with things like the LCMS, maybe the Wells, or something along those lines. We just recently declared fellowship with an African church that's like 6 million people, because it's one of the largest. It's actually the largest Lutheran church in the world, and it's in Africa. And we declared fellowship with them, and we've done that. Like, here and there, it seems like every convention we get a couple of them where we're starting fellowship with them. But we have a lot of actual conservative ties. Now, is this particular Lutheran church, not this one, but the one we saw, is that one in line with the LCMS? I couldn't tell you. I honestly couldn't tell you. But my guess is that they probably would be. And to be completely fair and honest, with a place like this, it seems the more persecution you experience, and this is going to sound really weird, I'm sorry about that, but it seems the more conservative the branch of Christianity you find. Yes?
Google says 1694.
Okay.
And it's an ELC church.
Yeah, the ELC doesn't mean much. Yeah, unfortunately, letters and acronyms don't really work outside of the States. See, the ELCA here is the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. But even we used to be known as the Evangelical Lutheran Church of the Synod of Ohio and other states, I think, or something like that. So, and you know, most, actually, churches that are really old, like ours, if you go back into our history, more than likely we are called the Evangelical Lutheran Church. And one of the most conservative synods within the states is the ELS, the Evangelical Lutheran Synod. So the problem is that those initials don't mean a lot. You'd have to look at their doctrinal statement. And
what's about Wisconsin?
Huh?
What's about Wisconsin?
Yeah, Wisconsin Synod. It all boils down to what their subscription level is to the Book of Concord. And I know that sounds really weird.
But there's two basic types of subscription. And one of them, because we like Latin, right? Everybody likes Latin. One of them is called a quia subscription. One of them is called a quantus subscription. The ELCA has what they call a quantus subscription. That is, they believe that the Book of Concord is correct insofar as, which is the quantus, insofar as it agrees with Scripture. To put that in basic light, they're saying parts of this don't agree with Scripture, therefore we don't agree with parts of it. The LCMS, Wells, ELS, and most conservative synods have what they call a quia subscription, which means it says, we agree with the Book of Concord because it lines up with Scripture. So that's saying, the Book of Concord lines up with Scripture, therefore we agree with it. And now we might fight about some of the little lines in between and how we should like look at those and so on and so forth, and that's where you get the Wells and the ELS and all that. But truth be told is we still have what they call a because of, or a quia subscription. And that, if that's not really confusing, I'm sorry. I'm working my best here. But that's the main difference between most liberal bodies of Lutherans versus most conservative bodies. Conservative bodies have a tendency to have a quia subscription where they say, well, the Book of Concord, that is the book of our confessions, it lines up with Scripture. Therefore, because of that, we agree with it. So, again, it might not sound like a big difference. In what way are you referring?
Well, theologically, I think that probably there are less conservatives.
The ELCA is pretty liberal. You can go into their bylaws and actually start looking at some of the stuff that they purport and believe in. They've rejected large chunks of Scripture just by saying that it's a good story. In fact, there is one particular ELCA professor that believes that all the Bible is a good story except for the resurrection of Jesus. So he's literally, in his eyes, he's cut everything back down to that one little part. And he says, I agree that this happened, but everything else is just a good story. So yeah, there are some liberal Lutheran churches. There are. All right, so this is one of the altars. Again, this is this setup is split between three different churches. This, I believe, is an Anglican altar that they have. They do not hold, I think, big worship services or anything here, but it's just kind of one of their claims to the area. And I took a picture because it is neat. This is also right by, like right over here, is the exit for the cave. And there's the cave. See, we got to go to the exit and look in. So there's the cave. There's the part right here, the actual supposed spot where Jesus was born. I do not have a picture of that. You can look it up online, try to get a better picture than I have, but we've gotten anyway, because I was looking through like a peephole in a door. So, because we were unwilling to wait for 3.5 hours, it was going to take us to go through a line.
Are there people in there?
Yes. Yes, there are people in there. And on top of that, by the way, that 3.5 hour line, that does not include, remember, this is controlled by the Anglican Church, this section is. And the Roman Catholic, so they have services in here. So they will stop the line and have a 1/2 hour service. And so that 3.5 hours does not include that. You're just assuming they're not having a service in any case. True. All right, now we're going to head down to another area, and this is kind of one of the entrance parts of that other area. Let's see if I get to it. Hold on, there it is. We are heading down to another cave that is actually right next to the original cave. This is where I went to the door and was able to go into the people. This is the cave of St. Jerome. Now, for most of you, that doesn't mean a whole lot, or maybe it does, I don't know. St. Jerome wrote the Vulgate in like the 5th century. The Vulgate's a Latin translation of the Bible. It was the Latin translation of the Bible they were still using at the time of Luther. Now,
That doesn't mean he's bad. Actually, this guy was pretty awesome. He basically was a hermit who basically lived in this cave most of his life translating the scriptures. Pretty cool, I think. But these are some of the things that they have kind of memorialized in this cave. His cave is the same cave. It's just they have a door in between. The two areas. Oh, there's the entrance to the cave. Why do you? I got my pictures out of order. My apologies, but that's okay. Everybody, this is Bethlehem.
Looks like
this is Bethlehem. These jugs on top. Anytime you travel in the Middle East, especially in Israel, these tubs mean you're looking at a Palestinian or a person who is Islamic. They put them up there to save water because they don't trust the government and they don't trust anybody controlling their water supply. You sound familiar? So what they do is they put tubs, and they'll have two tubs. They'll have a white tub and a black tub, right? Hot water, cold water. Uh-huh. So, there is us going through the streets of Bethlehem. We had a very particular street that we had to go through. I got the feeling that maybe some of the other streets were not the best place to be on. Bethlehem is, yeah. Here we are just looking up at one of the towers of the churches. I don't think we went in that one. Yeah. That's us looking ahead. Here we are. Now, we're actually on this. Remember I said that the Bethlehem Lutheran Church was on top? This is what I mean. This is actually us on a plateau looking down on the streets. We just kind of come in from the side.
Are those eateries, or do they sell things?
It's a marketplace, yeah. Again, Bethlehem's all about tourism, so about everywhere you go. Bethlehem is really known more or less for their olive wood. They have lots and lots and lots of olive wood. So like sometimes you'll find things like made in the Holy Land or something like that. If it's made out of olive wood and it's handmade, probably came from Bethlehem. They have to get a special license to actually deal with the olive wood and all that kind of fun stuff. So more than likely. Now, that doesn't mean that nobody outside of Bethlehem has that license. They do. But more than likely, it probably came from Bethlehem. That's where most of the skilled craftsmen in the olive wood department. So, yes?
Okay. I'm not going to come to
the door. Oh, you are not.
Yes, I think it's a girl. Okay, so you showed us a picture of the door, Jesus was born.
Yeah.
You keep calling it a cave.
Yeah.
Okay, so back then, they kept their animals in a cave? Because I know it's a song, Away in the Manger, I always thought it was like a stable that you would
want. Yeah, well, you got to understand that the way they built their houses, if you're building a house back then, it's not like you're building a house nowadays. Like nowadays, you get big construction companies to come in and haul bricks and move stuff and so on and so forth. Most of the houses back then were two stories. The first story was used to keep animals in, but it was also your kitchen. So like during the day, you would shoot your animals out and you would put a fire like in the middle or somewhere like that. And you would cook and do on, and then at night, remember, especially if it got chilly, your animals were coming in, right? So that's kind of the way it was. Then on the second story, that's where you would sleep, or, you know, that's where you have your big, if you had like a big dining room, like a special room, you would put it up there, hence the upper room, right? You go into the upper room, and we talked about how Jesus had his last supper in the upper room. That's what we're talking about. Or the inner room, sometimes it's called, but either way, it's the same difference. Well, if you were in Bethlehem and in the first century and you were building a house, the first thing you do is look for a cave. Because then you don't have to build a first floor. You just pop a hole through it and then put your house on top. And then all of a sudden, now you have your two floors, but your first floor is taken care of. Saves you money, and it's easier. And if the cave is really big, you got lots of space. So basically, because we're on a hill and there's lots of caves, and there's lots of caves all over the place, but because there's a hill and there's lots and lots of caves, more than likely what happened, and what most scholars believe, is that that's basically the inn or the house, if you want to say it,
was actually just built on top of a cave, which is very common at the time.
And so even Bethlehem Lutheran Church was built on a cave.
By the way, we always talk about the inn. There was no room for them at the inn. Do you realize that that word used for inn there is actually the same word used for upper room like 10 chapters later? So was there actually no room for them at the inn? Or was there no room for them at a family's house in their upper room? Good question.
Mr. Scholar, what's the answer?
It's a question. We have questions, right? We like to have questions. Can't tell you everything, then what would I preach on? Oh, man. Oh, I'm going to go through the stained glass windows. There we go. Okay, this is the courtyard of St. Jerome. So here we are back at St. Jerome's cave. This is actually the old stairway that led to the cave. This right here, very thin, but that was the old stairway. They since moved the stairway. And this right here is actually a church. And they've moved the stairway into the church. But I took a picture right here. You can't really tell, but they're actually having service. We had to wait for the end of service. So they were having a service in St. Jerome's cave. Because they have services every day.
That's pretty. Can you back up one? I saw a star. Yeah. I see the stars.
Yeah. Well, you know that first church I showed you where I had the cave and all that kind of stuff? That's right here.
Okay.
And so there's like a little courtyard, and then here, boom, is St. Jerome's cave. And the Catholics have control of St. Jerome's cave because he's a saint in the Catholic Church. So. So you're kind of looking back down, seeing if you can see the service. If you look close enough, you actually, you can't on this picture, but there's actually stairs right here. Very, very steep stairs. Here's some of the walls inside the church. I'm sorry, my pictures are all out of order. I thought I had them in order, but apparently I do not. And there's a picture you can't see. Oh. Okay, I've switched gears. Oh man, I really got these out of order. This is
computer.
Yeah, I blame it on my computer, not me. Surely I didn't do it.
It puts them in order.
I would never do such a thing. No, this is actually. This is actually inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. This is not the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, but like the Bethlehem Church, it's split among the three churches. This is the Greek Orthodox side. So that's where these came from. Now we're back to Jerome's cave. Okay, so like I said, I'm a little out of order. My apologies, guys. If you were looking at one Greek Orthodox church, you could see why I might be confused. Anyway.
Did you take all these pictures, or did other people take them?
I took some of them.
So, you know, what your computer probably does is it puts them in the order that they were taken. No matter how you put them in.
Yeah, but it does.
It changes.
That might be true, but I did it before.
I'm running into that. Okay.
Here's the altar. Oh, we got a question.
Were you drinking your homemade beer?
What now?
Were you drinking your homemade beer?
I did not drink my homemade beer. Because mine is in the kegs right now. Getting ready for next week. I am out in a sense.
I spent most of last night cleaning my kegs.
You can kind of peer through some of these things and see, because some of the ancient caves are left untouched. They put a light in there, but that's really the first century style cave in the back. I know it's not a very good picture, but hey, it's hard. You're in a cave. But this was, like I said, one of the things is this is just beautiful. Like, we're all underground. And this is just how they carved it out of this. And then put a church on top, basically.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm pretty sure the Catholics know Latin better than I do. So. But yeah, just beautiful imagery throughout the cave, I thought, anyway.
Did he choose that cave because of the light source?
It's very possible. It's hard to say. I know the church that was there was not built in the 5th century, so it's very possible that he just kind of had this cave. And that's one of the things that was interesting, too. Like, even when we went on some of our walks, you did run into, like, hermit caves, like places where people just came and lived their lives and then died and separated themselves from people, basically. And this is kind of where St. Jerome did that. You know, he went to this cave to translate the Bible, and that's what he did, spending the rest of his life, not just translating it, but kind of fixing his translation and so on and so forth, all by hand, right? No printing press, no computers, no smartphones, you know? Some clearer pictures here. So that's St. Jerome's cave, right next door to the Bethlehem cave, and actually technically the same cave, just a different side of it. Here's another view of Bethlehem. Notice the Arabic Coca-Cola. So kind of on the streets here. Okay, that's Bethlehem. That's an aqueduct. That's one of them. These things, we're kind of getting it a little bit, again, into the Roman era again, and you're starting to see some of that Roman design and ingenuity. A few of my pictures actually have that. And so this thing is just, this is miles from town. They just built this thing, going a hole all the way along it, and then they put it like a pipe, they put a top on top of it so there's nothing getting the water, and the water would just flow slightly downhill. Not a lot, but just a little bit. So we were actually at a beach. We went to the Mediterranean Sea, and there it was, just a big old massive chunk of it. This next slide, or next several slides, actually, a couple slides, a very interesting town that we went to. And what was interesting, a couple things that were interesting about it. One, it's not a place that a lot of people go. They take Jewish children to this place as part of like their school field trip kind of thing. But not a lot of tourist groups go there. And it's really interesting because they found a town, you know, like they do. And then this group decided to rebuild the town the way it was originally built. And so you have a partially restored town. And so you can actually go into the houses and you can kind of see what they look like. This would have been more or less first century. And this is kind of what they think is a stairway up to the bedroom. It's incredibly dark. And they have a little spot where you can put a candle. So, but you have like two spots for candles, and you could barely, even with those candles, you really couldn't see real, real well. And so what our professor did, which was actually kind of awesome, he took out a quarter and flipped it. And it landed on the ground, and he said, find the quarter. You wouldn't believe how hard it was to find a shiny quarter in the midst of this room. And then he had us read the parable of the lost coin. Oh. And then you think about it, like, that coin probably wasn't shiny. And you're looking, and this is in the middle of the day, bright sunshine. Right? Not a cloud in the sky kind of thing. Maybe there's a cloud in the sky. But it was real bright. And so even if you had a candle in here, it wasn't going to be that much brighter. Okay. So just to get a general idea, the story of the lost coin made a whole lot more sense after you do that. Because, you know, the first story, the time you read the story, like, this house isn't that big. You know, she's all sweeping. You know, but once you realize that they have this, like, almost like cobblestone, except for bigger, all these big, big cracks, Well, how do you get things out of the crack? Well, you sweep it. You try to get stuff out of the cracks to kind of find it. So, interesting. It also had this other part where it had a partially destroyed synagogue. Would have been very similar to a first century synagogue. And they had this little thing you could look through to see what it would look like if it was restored. Just in your case, it made you look goofy trying to look through this thing. Like that. We all took our turns trying to look at it. See, you can see the picture right here. So that's what you got when you looked at it. And you saw the destroyed synagogue.
So what town is it?
Oh, I have to look at my GPS. I can't remember the name of the town. But you can see, like, here's parts of it that are still kind of destroyed. But then over here, here's a rebuilt part. And up here is all rebuilt. One of the other things that's unique about this town that I thought is the roadways. They're like maybe twice the width of this table at the most. And that's the roadways in between towns. Now again, when you read the scriptures, and it talks about Jesus, and going getting people pressing up against him, and they're trying to walk in, you can imagine if there's any busyness at all. Like, people are everywhere. It's going to be hard to get through anywhere, but everything's so close. All right. Now here's one of the unique the other places. This is not Capernaum. This is really okay. So now you get into this fascinating stuff. A lot of people. There's this big church they discovered on a hillside, and for the longest time, everybody said that this church was it was a church set up in like the 3rd century or this one was built later, but it was built early on. And it was built to, like, be where Jesus cast the demons out of pigs, kind of thing. And as they uncovered the floors and everything else, they still say this. If you go to this town, they'll still say it's like this story over here. But what's really interesting is, like, the floor is covered with murals of wheat and fish. And so if you were memorializing a specific church event that happened, you know, in Jesus, that Jesus performed, if you were talking about the casting out of swine, you probably wouldn't put wheat and fish all over the floor. However, if it's the 3rd century and you're marking specific locations and something else happened, you might put a church there, say, the feeding of the 5,000. You might put, you know, bread and fish or wheat and fish. But anyway, the floors, and it's not real, real good. You can't really, really tell on this. But, yeah, this floor is just covered with images of wheat and fish. And this is the only picture I have of a 1st century thing in Capernaum. Actually, this is a 3rd, 4th century. I couldn't find my pictures. I think they're all videos, is my problem. I have videos, but not good pictures. This is a 4th century replica of a 1st century synagogue in Capernaum. I think I've brought this up before. I may have even found a better picture before. I couldn't find one the other day, though. So, way back when in the 4th century, they realized that there was something called tourism. And so they built a synagogue which would look similar to the one Jesus would have gone to. They were building them different at that time already, but the Jews decided to build one that would look like a 1st century one, because they realized that all these Christian folk would flock to it and want to look at it. And so it looks like a 1st century synagogue, but it's not. That's Peter's house in Capernaum. Not the spaceship on top, it's what's underneath the spaceship. That spaceship is actually a church. This is why I was a little disappointed by Capernaum. Welcome to Capernaum, everybody. Where you have to look underneath a spaceship to see Peter's house. And I do, it's like cone-shaped out and in. So it really is. It looks like a spaceship. It's a big old, it's a Catholic church in the Catholic Church, you can go, when they're not having service, of course, you can go in there and they have plexiglass floors. And so you can look down and see yourself. Which is all well and good, but if you want to see it from the side, you can see it, but it's not easy. There's us trying to venture it. See, you can kind of see it. See, there's the... This is the top or the floor of the church, and then this is Peter's house. What's unique about Peter's house, among other things, is that, and by the way, just in case you're wondering why we think it's Peter's house, it's pretty good archaeological evidence that says it's Peter's house. So lots of points. But what's really unique is, like, you have this internal house, which is like a normal, everyday house. And then it's like somebody in the first century started tearing their walls out. And they built other walls around it. And the walls had eight sides. Eight sides is a good symbol, an early Christian symbol for baptism. And so Peter is ripping out his walls of his house and rebuilding them to point us towards baptism. Now think of 1 Peter, right? Baptism now saves you. He emphasized baptism. But, because it was a pretty much an early church, right? House churches kind of thing. Well, he ran out of space. So he built another level of walls. See, he kind of extended out there and built more walls. Again, he kept the eight-sided design though, to emphasize baptism. So you have two sets of walls. This was basically Peter's house, but it was also kind of functionally a church in the first century. Yeah. So there's eight sides there to symbolize baptism. Peter points us to baptism. You know, 1 Peter 3, baptism now saves you. Peter is really, yeah. And this is the house that you can barely see because there's a spaceship on top of it. This is a roadway. One of the interesting things about the roadway, and this is... Fair point. One of the interesting things about the roadway here is that you can actually see these grooves in it. Those are chariot grooves. They had so many chariots go over the rock that it actually grooved the spot into it over time. And these are all solid stone, by the way, and they're the hard stone. Imagine how long and how many chariots would have to go over the same spot over and over again. By the way, you can uncover, some of the sides of this road are a little bit uncovered, and you can actually see, when it's uncovered a little bit on the side, you can actually see how smooth this is. It would have been a smooth, smooth road. That's not. It was, when it was first built, a smooth, smooth road. But over years and years of abuse and use by chariots, it became not so smooth.
In fact, one day you try that.
Apparently, several of you turned over thousands of years. But yeah, so this is a famous route. Now we're going into Galilee, apparently. I'll show you. Oh, my pictures! I gotta love them. This is the Sea of Galilee. We're on a boat that is supposedly a replica of a first century boat. Here's a quick point of fact. It's not. Unless they took the first century boat and like made it like 10 times bigger than what it was. I'll show you a picture of the first century boat here in a little bit and you will see what I'm talking about. Because this is holding a pretty good sized group. Actually, this is just holding our group of 14 people, but it could probably hold, I don't know, 40 people. It's a good-sized boat. There's no way a first-century boat carried more than, like, five. So, there's a first-century boat. Have I shown you guys a picture of this before? Okay. This is a really unique find. They found it in like the 60s, I think it was. Two brothers. At the time, the Israelis were starting to do more farming. And because of that, the Sea of Galilee shrunk. Because that's where they were pulling all their water from. And when the Sea of Galilee went down, two brothers found basically a tip of this boat. And they uncovered it, and they realized what it was. They didn't know how old it was, but they realized it was an ancient boat. And so they got these people out there to dig this boat up and uncover it. Really fantastic story, because it really shows you the work that you have to go through. Because the water was starting to rise back up. And so they were on a time crunch. And so they had to like dig it out and put like this foam stuff over top of it to save it from crumpling in on itself. Because every time they dug it out a little bit, it just crumbled. Because it's first century, and it's 2,000 years old. And things don't really make it that long. But anyway, so they had to dig it out, and then they had to get this foam on it. And then even after they took the foam off, they had to put the special coating, the special material on it, just to keep it from basically having anything to do with the elements. If that coating were to ever come off of it, the boat would just simply crumple into nothing. So they have it coated, so it looks almost shiny when you see it, but it's not originally shiny. But it's really fascinating, and it's a good study on first century boat making. Because they have the boat, but they found all these different types of wood in there. And basically it shows somebody who is a poor fisherman, who goes here and his boat breaks, and he has to find another piece or something and put it on there to fix it, and then he goes on and so forth. But at some point, it gave out and it sunk, and then was covered with dirt, and basically lasted for 2,000 years, and there it is. So, but that's supposedly the boat I was on that was hauling, that could haul 40-some people, is a replica of that. And that's the width of it, too. The two sides come up, and there might have been a base layer on top, but that's, there you go, first century fisherman's boat. So, you think like, all the disciples and their boating, right? Something like that. Of course, that one's not complete, but complete. Hypothetically, it could have been their boat. Could have been. All right. It is. And my brain has given out on me. I know, right? This town is one of infamy. But I can't think of the name of it. It's the one that's the gate of the devil. Huh? Thank you. This is the gate of the devil, and that cave is part of the reason it gets its name. The other reason it gets its name is because basically up in here is a bunch of false gods and idols. So this is Caesarea. And again, all these caves and carvings. These are all different various places. But that big cave a lot of times is considered the kind of the big gate. Some people thought that was the gate. It probably has collapsed. Who knows what it looked like originally? But some of it has probably collapsed over the years. But this is a really nasty, infamous place. Okay, we've crossed over to another town. Look at that. So there's Caesarea Philippi. And now this is the Decapolis, one of the Decapolises. And this is kind of their stadium. Well, yeah, their stadium. And up here would have been another ring of seats, but it's kind of fallen down. You can kind of see it over there. It's giving you a hint of the size of the town. This is actually a road that would go all the way through. There, that should give you an idea of the size. So here's the stadium over here. Here's the roadway. This would have been the main road. I've talked about this town before because it was destroyed by an earthquake. All these pillars, they all fell the same way. And that's why they pretty sure this town was destroyed by an earthquake. All right. This is a first century tomb. I can't remember, did he show you any of that in any of the videos? First century tomb? He never went, okay. This is a first century tomb. He has a video, Dr. Zelt has a video. This is where it's recorded at, is this particular tomb. It's very ornate. Somebody did some carvings and so on and so forth. Very pretty. If you were really wealthy and you had time and you wanted to create a family tomb, this is how you would do it. It's very possible that the tomb that Jesus was laid in looked very similar to this. Now, Jesus was not laid in this tomb. Actually, to be honest with you, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is probably where Jesus was laid, but he probably had something like this that was like over top of him, around him, that has since been destroyed. It's been destroyed because Helena, Constantine's mom, basically destroyed it so that she could build a church on top of it. It's a long story, but that's what she did. But anyway, so this has probably been, the one that Jesus was laid in has probably been destroyed. But this is very similar. It's a first century one. So that you can get a feel for what it looks like. And again, it has the whole kind of marble slab or slab where you can kind of lay a body and wait for it to decompose. And then you have the kind of the areas where you can put the boxes in the back. Again, somebody very wealthy. And this is another tomb. This is a different one. This one's up the road from that same one. But one of the things that's unique about this one is the stone. We talk about a stone, and we talk about a very large stone. Now, this is not a very large stone. This is considered a medium stone. So not a small stone, but not a large stone. So the one that was in front of the tomb of Jesus would have been much, much larger. But you get a general idea of what that looks like in terms of they kind of put a groove on here. Now the groove actually would go up and over, so you could actually hoist the stone up there. But this is one that's kind of been opened. And so you can see it leaves you just enough room to where if you were trying to get in there to put spices, you could kind of squeeze on by. You know, you're not going to completely open it, but you're going to kind of be able to squeeze by. And that's when the women are going to the tomb to anoint the body of Jesus. This is what they're saying. They're saying, who's going to be there to open the stone so that we can squeeze by, so we can get in there and we can anoint the body of Christ. So, the first Easter morning, this is kind of what they're heading towards. Again, the stone they were probably heading towards, probably a little bit larger, but same kind of concept. Here. Okay. Alright. We've got a few minutes. Is there any questions on that? Yeah.
What is that place in the church that people go?
It's a slab. It's a slab that they supposedly laid the body of Christ on. But what I'm saying though is there used to be an entire building built around it. Or at least if there was a cliff edge maybe into it. But what happened is whenever Constantine's mom, see, Constantine's mom was a Christian, and Constantine eventually became a Christian, and you know, the whole third century thing. And so what Constantine's mom did is she went around finding all the holy sites, Christian holy sites, and marking them. However, you know, sometimes you like the way she marked it because she made a note of it, sometimes you don't. This is one of the times whenever I don't, but maybe everybody else couldn't be there. I don't know. She basically ripped the building down, the entirety of the building, except for that slab. She left the slab in place, and then she built another church around the slab. So that's kind of what she did. So she memorialized the place, but not in the way I would have chosen to do it. But anyway. All right, so here we are. Now, this is actually at the Mount of Olives. They have a massive church here at the Mount of Olives. Again, every significant site to some degree had a church by it, or a couple churches by it. So we're on the Mount of Olives. There's a very beautiful church. It's hard to see. It's dark, and it's kept dark for a reason. They kind of, you know, the whole prayer at Gethsemane kind of thing that they're memorializing. So it's some of these pictures probably not the best. But they had huge murals. Again, Jesus praying, angel of the Lord. There's the church from the outside. So when I say it's a big church, it's a big church. Now, how'd that get in there? See, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. I don't even know. Anyway.
Yeah, you're right.
Thank you. I love you, Steve.
You have to renumber it if you want to stay in order.
No, okay. I think that's that picture. But here's the last picture. This is just the Mount of Olives. These are olive trees on the side that are supposedly, you know, like a gazillion years old, but really are not a gazillion years old. All right, well, that's all I have, and I think we're out of time. Well, look at that. Buzzer. Buzzer perfection, right? Yes, my pictures are all out of order. Sorry about that. Next week, we'll be dealing with more or less modern Israel, and I'll probably bring in some of my souvenirs. You guys can pass them around and kind of see a few things. Basically, just pottery shards and coins. Not a whole lot, but something. Anyway, so I hope you kind of enjoyed our walk around the New Testament. Hopefully, you guys are beginning to understand what I'm saying, though, in terms of, you know, here's the Mount of Olives. Very, you know, this is a big old church, but it's like everything was tourist central. Like, look at all the people. You know, and Capernaum was the same way. There's just people everywhere. So very, very much more of the touristy kind of feel to it, as opposed to a lot of the Old Testament sites we went to, which did not have that much of a touristy feel. But anyway, so, yeah, there we go. Any questions before we go?
Oh, man.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
I can certainly see you like cave.
Sorry.
Do you have a man cave at the parsonage?
To a degree, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm bringing back the old studies, though. I have books everywhere, you see. If I could just surround every wall with bookshelves, I probably would. So, there you go. All right. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming today. And God's blessings on your week and Sunday. And we'll...
God, we want to take a picture of several different...